Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of August 29th through September 5th. This week marks our 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks issue, and here we offer two perspectives on that event. One is from David O'Brien, former professor of history at the College of the Holy Cross, who writes in the current issue about his memories of that day and some of the stories of loss, courage, and heroism that he encountered. Second, we have a conversation with Father Robert Robbins of the Archdiocese of New York, who has been involved for many years in interreligious dialogue, and he speaks about interreligious dialogue in the wake of September 11th.
Well, there are these moments as you look back on your life, you know, when there was an experience in which Americans really felt themselves kind of bonded together, huh? Kennedy's funeral or the Oklahoma City bombing. There were these different moments, the Challenger disaster, when you really do have the, and the stuff in Arizona, you know, you have this sense that everybody's watching television, having a common, almost liturgical kind of experience, you know, that does give us a sense, at least for a moment, that we are kind of one people, you know. And I used to say that I used to say that people talked about the 60s and things had changed in the 60s, but for me, and I think for a lot of the students I work with and for the people I hang out with, one of the things that changed in the 60s was the change in the feeling about America, you know, and some very foundational kind of emotional sense of the nation, you know, that the kind of feeling we had in the 50s, and I always talk about it, my 1960 graduation with President Eisenhower and Cardinal Montini, like Pope Paul VI and Tom Dooley all there on the stage, you know, was did it all kind of fit together, you know, and it didn't fit together later, and there was a sense of disconnect between our, in our case, between Catholic faith and America, but I think even more deeply a kind of disconnect with the American civil religion that an awful lot of people went through in the 60s and 70s, so that a kind of taken-for-granted patriotism, a taken-for-granted sense of responsibility for the country that was part of, I think, the culture of higher education when I went to Notre Dame, and even in graduate school when I met all these Jewish activists from New York and they politically educated me, just wasn't there anymore, you know. You had to kind of make the case for civic responsibility, whereas it was almost taken for granted before. And so anyway, that's something that I've been thought a lot about as an American historian. I taught a course called The Idea of American History, and so I always thought a lot about it, and 9/11 was one of those moments, wasn't it, when there was this overwhelming sense of being one people and going through a shared experience that was almost beyond our imagination. And Jim Dwyer's stuff about neighborhoods and the Irish, the great piece he did on one Irish community where everybody went back to the neighborhood for the funerals. And we had a couple of those funerals in the Worcester area, one from a girl whose sister was killed, a Holy Cross grad the previous year, who'd been killed, and it just was amazing. I think the sense of solidarity, and we struggle a lot with solidarity and common good, don't we, these days? And yet we had these moments when we really did, solidarity was a real experience, not just an idea, you know?
Yeah, you write about how it kind of reaffirmed for you that you were an Americanist. What do you mean by that?
Well, in the first, I suppose in the first and foundational way is that I kind of drifted into vocational choice. I don't want to dramatize this. I kind of tell people I went to graduate school to avoid a career decision, and then being an indecisive person, here I am, you know. And that's, there's a lot of truth in that. But whatever the interest was that got me to switch from business to history and then take history and go to graduate school and then do the things I did was about a kind of care about America, that I really was an Americanist in that sense. I was a Catholic too, of course, and I came from deep within the Catholic subculture, but I was very much interested in America, I guess, as a vocational interest, and it grew out in some sense of solidarity with or feeling some sense of shared responsibility for the country, you know? That's probably Kennedy-era stuff, you know?
Sure.
Yeah. So anyway, I certainly went through that, what everybody else did, the kind of Dorothy Day, Dan Berrigan stuff in the 60s, you know? But if you went back and looked at things I wrote even then in that first Renewal of American Catholicism and stuff, I remember quoting Dan one time about he being American and not being able to understand himself apart from it and stuff, you know. So even with them, and I think with Dorothy, there was a kind of sense of the country, you know. She always wanted to change America. I mean, she came out of an American radical tradition and while the faith stood in some critical relationship to the country, it was a critical relationship that wasn't that much different than she'd known when she was with the Wobblies or those people, you know. And then Dr. King was the big help, because King was obviously a critic and a prophet, but he was a prophet within and not apart from the American people. So I guess when I tell you, one turning point for me, Tim, was the Peace Pastoral, you know, when it came out. And if you go back and look at it, you know, you look at the Peace Pastoral, and we were all very heavily invested in the public discussion from draft to draft. But in the beginning of the fourth section of the pastoral, they have this language that I later found what came from Dulles, and it says it says we're living in a country increasingly estranged from Christian values, where we might expect persecution and martyrdom to become normal. And in the earlier drafts, they said a neo-pagan. We were living in a neo-pagan time. So I thought, wow, you know, I thought if you go down that route, you're going to get yourself in trouble. And I know that there's some of that in the Catholic left, and I felt some of it myself from time to time, but you can't go that route because you won't change the country. It's head for the monastery or the Catholic worker house or the caves, you know, or the catacombs. And that's not where we're supposed to be. Part 2 and 3 of that letter, where we were supposed to be down in Congress and the White House and camped out in front of the Pentagon, you know, trying to change the policy. But you can't do it from that angle. You have to really care about it and feel like it's yours and not somebody else's. So that really was a big turning point for me, and I became an anti-countercultural Catholic from that time on, and as Bill Portier and others say, the last Americanist, you know.
You cite some people who kind of inspired you, figures that emerged from 9/11. You mentioned Jim Dwyer, the reporter who was writing about some of these stories, Michael Judge, the Franciscan fireman's chaplain who died on that day. So here were people who were not kind of cordoning themselves off from the culture, but kind of...
Not at all. Yeah.
So maybe you could talk about that.
Right in the midst of things, you know, that's the whole business, you know. It's that Thomas Merton waking up one day in Louisville and saying, I love everybody, you know.
Right.
And that was the best of, I guess, the old Catholic thing. Remember Dorothy Day's meditations on being in church with all these people, you know, that she liked being there with all these people, even if some of them were birchers, she said, you know.
Here comes
and
everybody.
That was what was good about us. We did have a kind of sense that at some moment we kind of step back and we try to reach out to each other, whoever we are, you know. I remember the call to action process was so wonderful for those of us that took part in it, because we saw this remarkable diversity in the community and some pretty sharp divisions. And yet at each of those hearings and then in Detroit, the liturgies kind of brought everybody together, you know. It was, I thought, kind of amazing. So a lot of that happened on 9/11, didn't it? The sense that the usual barriers all came down, right? And then I was very taken with I was obsessed with those New York Times profiles that are collected now in
Profiles
book,
in Courage, yeah.
But they were just the stories of the victims. Remember those?
Portraits of Grief.
Yeah, they were just so remarkable. And I know they were, every family doctors up their obituary, right? Makes people, when they die, sound like they're saints. But it was just remarkable, I think, how good people were and how good the memories of people, of those they lost, were. And and I thought Dwyer caught that, you know, that for all their craziness, there was a lot of goodness in people. He's great because he has that kind of 1930s repertorial desire just to be there in the middle of the people and experience what's happening, you know. I say the 30s. I mean, if you ever go back to the 30s and read those journalists, James Agee's Not Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, I used to make students read that, and they used to think it was the weirdest weirdest book. But it is this amazing move. The photography, all that stuff, was just to capture the people as they are. Huh? What is it, John Ford? Did John Ford make Grapes of Wrath? And
right, John Ford, the director.
At the end, Ma says, we're just the people, Paul, and we keep moving on. You know?
Right.
So it is the 30s. I taught a course in the 30s when I first started teaching, and I used to love that stuff.
Yeah. Now, you conclude your piece by talking about we're coming on the 10th anniversary, there's going to be a lot of, you know, memories of these sad events, but you talk about all the love that was evident on that day, and that that is striking, you know, to kind of remember
the
it that
way. The guy that put that into words for me one day was, I heard Gene Kennedy speak at, I think it was at Fordham, but he was the one who said what I'd been thinking, and that is how many of these people, when they knew they were going to die, called somebody to say, I love you, and Gene put it like, religious leaders didn't pick that up, you know what I mean? I mean, religious leaders had a lot to say about it, but they didn't pick that up. That it really is kind of startling that time after time, even in that plane in Pennsylvania, they call up and say, I think it's all over, but I love you. So that's a theological, you would think that would be worthy of theological reflection, you know? And there was that love. And then in Dwyer's book, you know, and then some of the books about the what happened inside the buildings, you know, these stories of self, giving of self, right? The person that stays with the person in the wheelchair, those kind of people who go back upstairs to try to find people, you know what I mean? I mean, there's just a lot of that, and it really was quite inspiring.
Well, this has been very helpful. Thank you for kind of elucidating some of the themes in your article.
See you soon. Thanks, Maurice.
Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, why don't we begin? Maybe you can explain to our listeners the work that you do at the Commission for Ecumenical and Interreligious Affairs.
Okay, well, it's in a sense an umbrella group of the workings of the Archdiocese of New York. So we have workings with at least 20 Jewish communities in New York, with the Orthodox, including the Oriental Orthodox, and with the Lutherans and the Episcopalians, and we're in the process with Catholic Near East of trying to get a formal dialogue going with the Muslim groups.
Now, we're looking towards the anniversary of September 11th, which is just a month away. Perhaps you could tell me a little bit about what those days were like for you in New York, and maybe a little later about, you know, interreligious affairs, you know, post-September 11th.
Yeah, you know, where I live is right across the street from the United Nations, and I remember that morning well because it was, as people have commented, just a beautiful morning, and then all of a sudden I saw the shadow of a plane going over the rectory and said to myself, something's wrong, that there are no planes in Midtown Manhattan. So I turned on the TV and found out what was going on, and the chaos of the next couple of days and weeks with not only individual people's problems, but also with, you know, the burial of the dead and the consolation of mourners. It was a heavy burden.
And in the months and years, I guess, afterwards, I mean, there was a lot of discussion at the time about, you know, how much should Islamic faith, should it bear any responsibility for what these individual members did? Were there discussions about that? I mean, in your work, and you know, how did the New York Archdiocese go about trying to kind of bridge that gap that had developed, at least in some quarters?
We've been having discussions over the last year with our dialogue partners, and we all have basically said that this is the unhealed wound, and that we all take responsibility for the fact that in the meantime, we have not come to terms with what we should be doing religiously to help and to heal that wound. Because I think, you know, being here at the epicenter, we're still living in shock. It's 10 years, but that doesn't mean that we're not still living in shock. And so the dialogue with Muslims from different Christian groups, in a sense, has been very difficult, because what they would, you know, regard those people who were responsible for the attacks, they would call them terrorists, they would call them fundamentalists, and certainly there's none of us who doesn't have a group of fundamentalists among us.
Now, looking towards the anniversary, are there any events planned, kind of interreligious gatherings to mark it or to remember those, you know, those who died on that day?
The official one at Ground Zero, unfortunately, has been changed into something which is called non-religious. So there will be no religious leaders there. However, throughout the city, there are different observances happening, especially since it's going to be on a Sunday. I think many Christian congregations would certainly be doing something. The Conference of Bishops of the United States have given permission for us to change the Mass text on that Sunday to a number of options, either for justice and peace, or for the dead, or for people at war. So there is an understanding and an awareness that it needs to be addressed on that day. And I certainly know from talking to colleagues that different congregations are doing different things.
Now, looking, you know, in terms of how, you know, Christians and Muslims can mark this event together, are there ways in sort of an interreligious setting that can be done? I mean, can prayers be said with our, you know, Jewish and Muslim brothers and sisters?
You know, it's always a great thing about our present Pope and John Paul II and the original October 4th observance at Assisi that some theologians think that we can't pray side by side. But all being people of the book, I don't understand why that is. We don't have to acknowledge anything about one another's faith just to say a prayer together. So I think there certainly would be instances where the three groups could get together. I, however, do not know of any that are happening.
Now, maybe we can talk briefly about, you know, your work at the parish, being there near the United Nations. I mean, on a day-to-day basis, what is that like? Do you have a lot of people from the United Nations coming to worship? And
well, I usually tell people we have two parishes, one on the weekend and one on the weekdays.
Yeah.
And what we certainly would have during the week, Monday through Friday, would be workers from the United Nations here at both of our daily masses.
And then residents from the community on
residents in the community, and as I say, anybody else I can steal.
So obviously there are people at the United Nations who their faith is important to them, that this plays a real role in the work they do.
Oh, absolutely. As a group, I would say I have been impressed over the years with the faith that they have, which I think impels them to seek employment at the United Nations.
Well, are there any, maybe we can end by just saying, are there any special event, you know, since September 11 falls on a Sunday, as you mentioned, is there anything that you plan to preach about or to market in some way?
Well, it's interesting. The readings that are assigned for that Sunday are readings about forgiveness and understanding. And that's a big challenge on a day like the anniversary of September 11th, because it's a day where there's still a lot of anger, you know, below the radar, and there, in a sense, is September 11th was the origin of, I think, New Yorkers' awareness of Muslims at all, that, you know, the reflection ever that they were here before that, and it's become things like Peter King's investigations, you know.
This is the representative from Long Island who's doing
right.
kind of investigations into Islamic people living in this country.
Yes, and why the violence and all that. You know, we can go back in the cycle of this city and say the same thing about when the Irish came and when the Germans came and when the Italians came. It was always the same. One of the great unfortunate traits of humanity is xenophobia, which is, you know, the fear of an unknown stranger.
Well, Father Robbins, I want to thank you very much for taking some time to speak with us.
Oh, this is painless.